The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
Welcome, everyone. EMS Educast, as always, exciting to have you here. Fun things happening for us as we look ahead to 2012. This is the second to last episode of our 2012 recording season. We'll have one more, and then we'll have a bit of a holiday break where we always encourage you to go back into the archives at emseducast.com or on iTunes, listen to past episodes. I'm always surprised when I look at the stats to see episodes as back as February 2009, when we first started this thing, still get hits every month. And so it's neat that we've created an enduring resource. Also, make sure you check us out at facebook.com/EMSEducast. And I want to give you two specific assignments. One is, if you listen through some sort of iTunes subscription, please go on and write a review and rate the show. And then your second assignment is, go to facebook.com/EMSEducast and share something on the wall. Maybe it's a book or an event or something an app or something that you're using that you want to share with other EMS educators, much like we've been doing the last few months at the end of each episode. So those are your two assignments for the holiday break. Go back into the archives, rate and review the show, and share something with other listeners. Bill Toon, do you want to add any assignments for our listeners?
Now, I think the most important thing for your listeners during this time of the year is to remember the importance of family and to give yourself a little bit of a break and to relax and enjoy the holiday season. I just think that that's very important.
That is a great reminder. And Rob, how are you? And anything to add?
I'm excellent. The only thing I would add is make sure you select 5 stars.
Yeah, select 5 stars.
We don't ask for much.
Yeah. Is the question of like, well, what's better, 1 star or 5? It's always 5. And doing that is rating and reviewing a podcast. Of course, it's good for our egos and our vanity to see a whole bunch of 5-star ratings. But more importantly, it will help the podcast be found. It will show up better in searches, and that will expose us to even more listeners. So if you could do that, we'd appreciate that. And yeah, if 5 stars, or Rob's going to come and throw snowballs at you.
That's right.
And we are real excited to have a guest this week. Bill Rainovich is joining us from Nebraska. And Bill, welcome to the EMS Educast.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be here. Appreciate the invitation.
Well, the way we always start the show is we ask our guests for a real thorough introduction of how they got their start in EMS and sort of the career path they took to where they are now and what it is that they're doing now in EMS and EMS education. So give us a full and detailed picture of your career in EMS.
Well, sure. It's a pleasure. I got started really by accident. It was 1967 with the U.S. military, and as a U.S. Navy recruit, selection of what I might want to do, and without really having any real affinity for taking care of patients or anything, volunteered for the hospital corps training. And that led immediately to United States Marine Corps field medic training. So let's just say I grew up kind of quickly there. And after the few years of military services, an independent company field medic and U.S. Navy hospital corpsman came out and wanted to go to college and have a family and so forth, and figured I'm going to work my way through school. And I figured I've got skills that I could volunteer or work for an ambulance company. and went to work with Freedom House Ambulance, the pilot program. And this was the EMS Act of 1973, where EMTs were just being developed. In fact, it was still ambulance attendants when I came out and just getting started. The first EMT courses were beginning to be offered. So I had the chance to work with Peter Saffer and Nancy Caroline in the development of the National Highway Traffic Safety National Standard Curriculum, and earned a Bachelor of Science degree at Pitt while I was doing that. Well, I stayed in EMS and got to be the first training coordinator for the Center for Emergency Medicine in Pittsburgh to develop their paramedic course. Off from there to go start a program and work for 10 years in Eastern Pennsylvania at the Reading Hospital and Medical Center, and got a little itchy for new challenges, had earned a master's degree in public health at Pitt, so went off to University of New Mexico in Albuquerque to study and get a doctorate of education, but also to begin a bachelor's degree program. So in 8.5 years in Albuquerque, developed a bachelor's degree program. When I got recruited and had the opportunity to come up and get an assistant professorship and now an associate professorship up at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, and we're just getting ready to get started to launch a master's degree in EMS, so it's all pretty exciting, and I've had a very fortunate, lucky career.
Wow, Bill, that's an incredible background. Very impressive.
Two comments. One, Bill Toon, we might have found somebody finally that's been in this for longer than you.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah. And Bill Rainovich, you know, as you look back, did you think at the time when, say, you were working with Dr. Saffron and Nancy Caroline that book and the curriculum development would still be names that would be familiar to educators, gosh, almost 40 years later?
You know, I had to be just one of the youngest and most arrogant and aloof persons, because they had a national conference in Pittsburgh, and the world leaders and the big names from all over the world came to Pittsburgh and had this national conference. And Nancy Caroline said, you've got to go to that conference. This is it. I mean, you're going to meet everybody in the world. You've got a career and a future in this. And I honestly thought I'd still be, you know, filling up little lab beakers and just was above it. So I really didn't have a true sense of touching the history and the future. And it was just excitement. It was just pure joy of working in the inner city ghetto of Pittsburgh and being thrilled to be a part of EMS, but didn't understand what was going to be happening. I didn't have a vision for the future. 2020 hindsight is, I mean, hindsight is 2020.
And yeah, sometimes I wonder if that's, you know, if that's just the nature of being a young person. You know, it's, and when you're sort of in the moment to be thinking like, you know, we're laying down a path here that others are going to use for decades to come, it's tough to maybe see that when you're, you know, you're actually laying down the bricks rather than sort of looking ahead to where the road might be going.
I think that's pretty gracious, except that now I kind of think of myself as having matured into old stupid.
Well, the other thing I want to ask about, and then Rob and Bill certainly can jump in, is it sounded like you moved around a bit. You did, obviously, from different parts of Pennsylvania to New Mexico to Nebraska. And, you know, that's pretty tough to do, right, to sort of say to the family we're going and all that risk that's involved. And you know, again, looking back on it, what advice might you have for a listener that's maybe realizing that the program that they started building a few years ago maybe isn't quite as challenging as when they started, and looking at that decision of, well, do I just keep on keeping on here where I'm at, or do I look to go somewhere different, even if it means a cross-country move?
You know, that's a really great question, and actually it's maybe a compound or a complex answer, because when I was in Pittsburgh, it was 1983 and the steel industry just crashed horrifically in if you think about our 2008-2009 economic crash, well, we had one of those in Pittsburgh then. And so moving to a better job with a healthier economy was just a move that was almost compelling to make it, and it was tough. Everything you say about it, emotionally, going away from family, stepping into new territory, all combined with the one piece of advice is don't be afraid to take on those challenges. Here was a major hospital system in a county that had no paramedic program. To be able to take that challenge on and to go and do something that exciting. And when I arrived, you could go back and look at 1986 and the gyms in September. When I arrived there to work, in the article there was the Reading Hospital. I mean, not the Reading Hospital, but the city of Reading was deactivated for advanced life support because of inability to get paramedics to work. So really stepped into it. It was a challenge. The wife and I to go to New Mexico, we were ready for a change. There were some horrific snowstorms. It was 10 years of doing the same thing. If I'd have stayed there another 10 or 15 years, I'd have been doing the same thing. And this was a chance to go to a beautiful place and advance with a degree and build a bachelor's degree program from nothing. So again, not knowing what I was doing there, not knowing, you know, the challenge just far ahead of me and cutting a path, but just biting the bullet and going and doing it was exciting. I was lucky enough to have a wife and family that were 100% behind me and supported it. That was slightly different coming to Omaha because the chance to come to Creighton University is one of the, well, I'll just say, fabulous university, great academic reputation. And it's a small Jesuit college. I went from the 30,000-person state flagship University of New Mexico with a footprint as big as the whole giant state down to this little boutique Jesuit college. What a change. But the opportunities are different. The world is different. The culture is different. And I can only say that I characterize myself as an educational entrepreneur and an explorer. So we all, maybe the most important thing to say is know your own personality type, know who you are, but have the courage and go follow your heart and your dreams.
Thanks for that.
Bill, I'm very interested in your early time when you were in the military, because you obviously got in the military at an interesting time in history in this country. And so were you able to – what type of practice did you do while you were in the military? Because I think you said you were assigned to the Fleet Marines for a period of time.
Yeah, that's complicated because I actually didn't end up in Vietnam. The 5th Marine Division is a reserve Marine division. Now, I was actually a 2nd Platoon Corpsman for Echo Company, actually 3rd Platoon Corpsman for the 2nd Squad Corpsman for the 3rd Platoon of Echo Company, 2nd Battalion, 28th Marines, 5th Marine Division. You might wonder why I would tell you all that, except that that very spot was the hospital corpsman Bradley, who raised a flag over Iwo Jima. So anybody listening to this in the military will understand that you had that one identified spot which had a great traditional history for it. And being at that unit had tremendous racial and conflict implications and historical implications and so forth. And Vietnam was raging, and for the Tet Offenses, a couple of times, one time in particular, we were out and our bags were packed and the jets, the C-130s, were roaring on the runways at El Toro to take us off. And they got held back just enough. We were ready to take off and go. And in however many hours, an 11 or 12-hour flight or whatever it would have been, I would have been dropped off in the fields of Vietnam. So the time I was scheduled, Nixon was in effect de-escalating, the war was changing, and I was very fortunate just to never have to go in the war theater itself. But the practice was an independent practice to be trained as a field medic, to do all of those things that are just crazy, that you just go and do things beyond whatever the scope of practice is that you can imagine, doing the company calls. I would just say, for instance, the roll call, the sick call in the morning, we'd have a lineup of 100 guys to be seen. And if you ever went back and bothered the physicians who were in the room building their model airplanes and playing bridge, they were quite annoyed. So we actually got to practice independent practice then, which was pretty exciting.
So I just wanted to make sure I understood you correctly. The mention of John Bradley and Iwo Jima, the position you had would have been the same squad, because he was the medic for his platoon. Was that correct?
That's it. The exact same spot in the military as designated. Now, the story's kind of complicated because they were the Hollywood Marines. It was actually the 2nd Marines that really went up there and had all the Medals of Honor winners with John Shoup and the gang, and they got their butts kicked royally with all of the great sacrifices and so forth. And so after they went up and did the business, it was the 3rd platoon that walked – well, it actually was the 2nd platoon. That's why I got confused on the platoons for a moment. The 2nd platoon walked up and put up the flag and created the moment. And then they wanted a bigger flag, so it was the 3rd platoon that actually walked up later and carried the bigger flag for the photo op that's actually in the memorial itself. If you want to catch the history of it, Clint Eastwood's Flags of Our Fathers is just fantastic. It really relates the history pretty accurately.
Well, and I mean, it's sort of coincidental. We had dinner guests from Anago, Wisconsin a couple nights ago, and we were talking about John Bradley, who was from Anago. His family's still there, and the book Flags of Our Fathers is fantastic, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And thanks for letting me take that little tangent to clarify that.
My pleasure.
All right, now I'm going to jump in there again. So you have now all this experience in the military. What was it like when you transitioned to the civilian? Because obviously a different scope of practice. You were in the early days of EMS on the civilian side. Just a little bit of what that transition was like for you.
It was pretty amazing. Don't forget now, I had been pretty well prepped. As I told you, there was racial strife in the late 60s, and my military experience prepped me pretty interesting for being in an interracial setting. But what happened is the Freedom House ambulance, it was the riots of the 1968, the Martin Luther King assassination or killing riots that created a model cities and a lot of federal money for programs. So the people in the Poor Hill District of Pittsburgh had a chance to spend some money and said, what can we do? And what they needed was an ambulance service. The ambulance service for the city of Pittsburgh Hill District was provided by police officers who had no training, no equipment, a canvas stretcher. They would pick a person up by the arms and legs, put them in a stretcher, both officers riding in front to get to the hospital. So they approached Peter Saffer in the university hospital and said, can you do something for us to give us an ambulance service up here? And Peter was brilliant at writing grants and research, and he's, of course, the father of CPR, developed the country's first intensive care unit at Johns Hopkins, was now at the great University of Pittsburgh Med Center. People came in and said, we need something, and by the way, there's an unlimited amount of money behind it. Thus, he jumped into the world of EMS and really got it going. Now, when I say jumped into the world of EMS, that misrepresents it. He had been doing the CPR research all along. So having designed the Saffer S-tube and the CPR protocol, the standards that we follow to this day, adjusted a little bit, he designed this EMS system to work in Pittsburgh under the name of Freedom House Ambulance, which is still operational today as a civil rights advocacy group. So I stepped into an all-African-American organization which had hired intentionally people that were thought to be unemployable, who had no education to speak of, prison records, drug histories, whatever it was. And I was this white guy out of the military who they ended up hiring and putting on the streets of Pittsburgh as their pilot, first white person. So it was as interesting as you could imagine. an interesting cast of characters, and being in the very violent, I would have to say I didn't end up in Vietnam, so I can't speak of violence elsewhere, but I certainly was working in the violent community where I did see people then on the streets of the America shooting each other and stabbing each other and doing things like that. However, don't let me mischaracterize that. The people of Pittsburgh, even in the worst ghetto and some of the toughest conditions of my colleagues, were wonderful. And it was a great, rich human experience. Just very, very rich and varied and exciting.
Excellent.
Thanks, Bill, for looking back with us and sharing how those different experiences that you had. It's just really incredible to hear about it. And since the clock is moving fast, we did have you on the show to talk about more than just all the great things you've done, but also to talk specifically about teaching ethics. And like many of the episodes we've done in the last 3 months, this really came out of attending your presentation at the NEMSI Symposium in Orlando. I had a chance to sit in on that, and I think we'd even tried to get you on the show before, and I had to cancel at the last minute. But again, glad we could have you finally. But the presentation that you did was about teaching ethics and using a series of cases to both have some discussion about ethical dilemmas, but also how you might teach it. And maybe just start by giving us an overview of what the session was about and this challenge of teaching ethics. And then maybe if you even want to pose a dilemma to Rob and Bill Toon and I, we can talk through it.
Sure. I'll be pleased to do that. Traditionally teaching ethics all these years in the, I would call it the dark ages of the old pedagogy before the electronic era and social media and before, you know, the current screens, back to the old 35-millimeter slide projectors and things like that, we had a certain way of just lecturing and just said there's got to be a better way to do this. The way I would have taught before was, here's the EMT code of ethics, here's the lecture, here's the standard. And the better way to do it now, I think, and current pedagogy is to get the students facing tough challenges and present them with tough cases. So my introduction to the educators is, one, why is it so difficult to teach ethics, and why do we, I think, do it so badly? And I start with the description of the National Standard Curriculum and the new education guidelines. What is it, 600 pages of 60 lines per page, and ethics is one page of it. And then when you look at the one page, most of the page isn't really ethics. It says HIPAA and OSHA bloodborne pathogens or things like that. It's really things other than ethics. Ethics are a couple of lines in the entire scope of what we have, and ethics are some of the most challenging situations we face. Sure, you've got to be able to follow the protocols and the guidelines and know the standards and know all of the clinical care. But the ethics is what you face when you've got a choice between two wrongs. One violates one standard of human rights and justice, and the other one violates a standard of your code of practice, and one puts you at risk of losing your license, and you've got to make a decision as to what you're going to do. So the presentation is really about setting the beacon of doing what's right for your patient, and just knowing that if you do what's right for the patient, you're doing the right thing. You can account for everything else, but respect the patient's autonomy, the right to make their own decision for themselves, doing things for the right reason, for the good for the patient, and you'll be fine. And then delivering to the students the difficult cases. Now, the one case that I start with, and every year, in past years, I always began with a student talking, say, in a supermarket or on the street corner, whatever, loud enough to be overheard, and discuss the price to the community and to your local EMS service when you breach confidentiality. And that had been one of the most sensitive areas because people in healthcare and human beings, we tend to talk. Well, that's changed. And I go back again to social media. I think the biggest challenge that every EMS agency is facing and young people are facing themselves right now is your public bulletin board that never gets erased. You put a comment out there on Facebook, on Twitter, wherever you put it, and in a blog. And once it's out there electronically, it's trackable to you. It can be found later on. And if you violate a patient confidentiality, if you violate a standard of professionalism, it's there to be discovered. You might be applying for a job 10 years later, 15 years later, that still might be located. It still might be brought up again. So I bring a very real case that happened with one Kansas paramedic that did do that kind of violation, put it on a blog page or a Facebook, you know, in a blog page or a Facebook page and as a comment, anonymous, but got discovered 6 months later. Nearly lost an entire career, but went through every kind of crisis we could imagine, legal, financial, loss of position, and is still, as I understand it, working the way back to full integration. And I appreciated the fact that you folks followed up on that after my presentation and actually did an article that it can be even cited here after this presentation, if you like, correct?
Yeah, I think, what did I do? I wrote up some ideas post on NEMSI. I called it memo, social media training for the paramedic class of 2013. Is that what you were getting at?
That is what I was getting at. It was very well done. You made me very proud to see that a presentation I did had actually resulted in that kind of action. That was pretty nice.
Yeah, I actually started... I outlined all that during your presentation in Orlando. I was like, oh, I got an idea. I got to start writing this one down before it escapes me. But yeah, it was great inspiration for me to put this together. And we'll include a link to that in the show notes.
So Bill, you mentioned the case of the EMT who breaches confidentiality. Is that an ethical issue or is that a legal issue?
Well, it is both, and certainly anytime you break the law, you're breaching ethics too. Except sometimes you're breaching the law for the right reason, and that can get very, very cloudy, where you feel you have an obligation to convey something. But in this case, I can't say that breaching confidentiality is always breaking the law. That is, it might talk about a HIPAA violation, where you can't be selling information. But I just mean that you could be talking about a certain case, a certain location. You might not even mention a patient's name, but you might talk about the condition of the house, the neighborhood. It might be identifiable, but you've still cost your organization by a lack of professionalism and a lack of respect for the community. And getting students to understand that your words are so powerful when you think you're just out there maybe casually talking because it was exciting to you. You're a new person. You haven't learned the price of that yet. But how people view our profession when somebody's compromised it by breaching confidentiality or even spoken demeaningly of a patient or otherwise. So that was one of the cases. Like I said, I usually began there, but now I follow it with the social media first.
Because we talk about code of ethics and then ethics, and sometimes I have trouble distinguishing between the two. You know, code of ethics sort of falls under, in my perception, falls under more of a medical legal umbrella where there are certain things that we certainly don't do, like lie or breach confidentiality or inappropriate behavior, language, etc. Tell us about some of the ethical dilemmas, cases that you would discuss with students where there isn't so much a legal issue as more of a moral ethical dilemma that they might be faced with.
Well, sure. Here's one that is barely touches legal and can be argued both ways, but very real case. I remember the paramedic that I had as a colleague back in Pennsylvania, and down a little community. He had this little woman in her 80s. He routinely took her for her radiation treatments, and they had a wonderful relationship. And she said, now, you know, if anything bad ever happens and you come in here, don't you be, you know, putting that electricity in my chest or putting those IVs in me or anything. I'm ready to go, and I'm good with that, and so don't you ever do that. Well, the one day he walked in, and she went into V-fib right in front of him, and he shocked her chest. And she woke up with a shock of the chest from V-fib and said, I told you not to do that. Now, it's a
sorry, that's, it's, I'm sorry I'm laughing. It's almost laughable.
Yeah,
it's what delightful. A terrible scenario.
She was completely annoyed with him for doing it. And while it's kind of a feel-good story and anybody could put themselves in the position, the question is, and it's a very real question, do you or don't you shock the chest? And can you not legally? And the reason why I say it's a gray area is you can go to the system of the EMS system DNRs. We developed that EMS system DNR back in eastern Pennsylvania at that time so that it wasn't only a medical center DNR or the nursing home DNR, but there was one that EMS recognized. But the thing is, even in light of a DNR, even being anywhere certain or uncertain, do you or don't you shock that chest with a patient right in front of you at that moment when you just see that? And it's an ethical question that really gets legs and really can light up a room.
Do you think it's a dilemma for people even when there is a DNR?
I think the DNR really gives you coverage, and certainly I respect the DNR. And in the case of this woman, I would not have shocked the chest. I would have respected her wishes. But the person who does shock at that moment in a true witnessed arrest, and this person just went into V-fib in front of you, I can even struggle with myself as to whether you might. But I don't say that you're actually ever violating the law myself in delivering the shock in the world of EMS, but I think you are. I think it's an assault and a battery. So I can give you a split answer and argue with myself even while we're talking here.
There's so many other potential ramifications of not shocking when you don't have something in writing. You know, then you're faced with defending your actions based on your assertion that this person expressed to you that they wish not to be resuscitated, but when there's no proof and no one else is able to see that, then your career's in jeopardy. I can see how that would be a real crisis for someone. Someone who's telling me I don't want to be shocked, I'd be slipping them a piece of paper saying, write it down here and sign at the bottom.
Well, isn't that part of the challenge of when we try to take an ethical dilemma situation and sort of remove the dilemma by applying like policy or paperwork to it? Of, well, I can just, if we can just clearly articulate what this conflict's going to be, and then we'll say, well, if you have A, then do B. And B is look for a DNR, but then if there's no DNR, and then go back to A. That's part, I think, of what makes it difficult is
one of the dilemmas. So, I like is when you have you arrive at a scene and there's someone with a terminal illness who's in a back room who's now in cardiac arrest, and the family members are standing at the door saying, we called you because he was in a lot of distress but now he's dead and we're comfortable with that, and he didn't want to be resuscitated. We don't have a DNR, but we don't want you to do anything. How do you deal with that situation?
I had one in, again, back in the Pennsylvania days, real, and got to the hospital scene. The wife is on the floor looking about 75 years old, and the husband said, she's got a DNR order, but I'm not ready to lose her. Please do everything you can for her. And so I got down and I said, but she's got a DNR order. He says, I can call the hospital and you can talk to the doctor. So go ahead and do that. and he called the hospital. They got the doctor. The doctor got on the phone and said, don't do anything for her. She's a DNR. Don't do anything. And I said, okay, well, we're a little late. I have a tube in and an external jugular and, you know, I've been running fluids and given the first dose and have shocked a chest and you're going to be getting her. And got quite cursed out for that. And we don't have a protocol for slow procedures, you know, and you could sit there and go, he says she has a DNR, but I'm not ready to lose her. What do you do at that point? And I think you can always err on the side of delivering the care, but I'm not even comfortable saying that because there will be people hearing that that will be cursing me out there for even suggesting such a thing. That's the dilemma.
Right. Hence the nature of ethical dilemmas.
So I want to, Bill, how do you, so you talk about teaching ethical dilemmas. How do you do it in your program? What is your approach? And is it something that is threaded throughout the entire curriculum, or do you just spend a period of time on it?
We do the one presentation of it where it's delivered as a lecture in the beginning of the program. Throughout the program, I wish I could say that we do a great job of presenting ethical dilemmas, but no, we probably are very traditional, as most other programs are, delivering complex clinical cases just to get people up to speed and able to deliver, you know, do good clinical judgment and deliver the right care by the right protocols, getting ready to pass that big national registry exam and get ready for entry-level practitioners. My justification for that is partly that medical ethics, you can have practicing nurses and physicians in a hospital setting at the highest level of their professions, and they've got to call upon the ethics committee, bioethicists, chaplains, social workers, and it takes a reflective practice of people at a distance who can weigh out the guidelines. And we in EMS, that's why I say I cut ourselves a break going, you really can't be a great ethicist under the heat of an emergency at the moment. You can only learn about the problems and learn about the judgments and develop some courage about standing up for knowing that you're doing what is right and being able to say at any part, to anybody at any time, I did what was right for the patient, and no, that's your shield.
I guess the question is, what's right, or is right a perception?
Well, let me give you one of the cases that is fascinating, I think, for teaching and ethics, and that was hospital intubations. And we require a certain number of endotracheal intubations for people to finish a program. And we get the people in at the hospital, the paramedic team has just brought them in, and there's that one point where you just know you're not going to be able to save this patient, and you got a paramedic there who hasn't had the student there who hasn't had the tube yet, and could you pull the tube and let the paramedic reinsert the tube as the patient has been called, the code has been called, and the patient has died? And I can tell you that physicians were discussing that actively. We at the table, meaning a paramedics and physicians and EMS leaders and QA people sat around, and it's easy to make a justification. You're doing a greater good. You are helping future patients, and you are not hurting this person has just died. They are making a contribution to education. So I sat at the lunch table with a chaplain who was a very good friend of mine and had been to my house playing poker, and we ate lunch many, many days together. And I thought I would take up the discussion with him and just get his barometer on it, his read on it. And he trembled. His face got taut red. He looked at me. He pointed and he said, if I ever find out you're doing that, have done that, if I ever get any sense of it that you're doing that, I am going to the district attorney and getting you prosecuted. I will go to the state. I will do everything I can to see you use your license in your career for desecration of a body. That changed my thinking. I said, okay, I get it. Never again. And it will never happen. And now I understand an ethical boundary from somebody else's take. That's reflective practice when you see it through somebody else's eyes, because I was just looking at it in our way. We see dead people all the time, and we do things up to the point of we're pushing on the chest long after we're not sure, or long after we're sure that we could really save this person. You know, we've done the IVs on a person that, okay, they were declared dead later on. They were a witness. The rest, we realized maybe we never had a chance. But the moment you say that person's dead, the respect that has to be there ethically for the deceased. And I didn't have that compass for that, but I picked that compass up very quickly there as a real life lesson, an ethical lesson for me.
Well, you know, I want to not miss this opportunity. What happened in your discussion with him if you had consented the family to do it?
Oh, no problem. I mean, you go out and want to talk to the family and say, you know, would you mind? But that's a very, very awkward moment. The value of it, of course, is that the cadavers degrade in terms of being lifelike and certain stiffness and things like that. This was the brand new person that one microsecond earlier was truly alive and very much presenting like your actual field patient. Going out and consenting the family is fine, but asking for a consent to do a procedure like that, to me, is still very awkward to imagine doing that. It would be fine. I don't think there's any ethical problem if you can get the consent of the family. But let me pose a question to you. Is it ethical to go out and ask the family for consent to be allowed to do that at a time when you know their sensitivity? I suppose the same criteria could be extended to going out and asking for organs, so it probably is.
You know, I bring it up because I think it has some value to discuss, because even within hospitals where, you know, and it's changed certainly over the years, it used to be a very common practice in teaching hospitals in post-cardiac arrest to allow interns, residents and everything to do sophisticated procedures on a patient post-cardiac arrest, post-declaring them. And then there's been a lot of discussion that that should only take place if there's been consent of the family for something like that to take place. But I'm going to take it one step farther, since you run a paramedic program. Do your students or an instructor consent every patient prior to a student performing a procedure on them?
You know, I find that those programs that go in and get the consents are able to do so. And I cannot say that our program does get consent for every patient, because that's really under the guidance of the many hospitals that our students go to. So that's under the anesthesia department policy for that and in each individual teaching situation. So it isn't our program policy to limit that, but I certainly am supportive of that personally and feel that that is the way it should be done. And I personally would have a problem going in for a surgery and having a tube put in by a paramedic student without me knowing about it and having, you know, not given the consent. But having been a patient, I sit there and go, yeah, I could be annoyed by a lot of things that I know were done that I found out about after the fact. Sorry about that. That's not much of an answer. I'm not very good at teaching this stuff, I guess.
Well, no, I think we have an active program where we take our paramedics back into the operating room. Once a week we're in the operating room, and that's our practice. We go and see the patient first and get their verbal consent after the anesthesiologist makes sure that it's an appropriate patient for us to speak to. And we wouldn't have it any other way. And, you know, people ask me, you know, we probably, and I can't tell you this for sure, but I would say maybe 10, 15% of the patients say no after I explain everything that's going on. And I'm okay with that, because if something was to go wrong, chipped tooth, a laceration, anything, a fat lip, and they weren't aware that some other practitioner other than the anesthesiologist or the CRNA was doing it, I think that they would have a right to be very upset.
Sure, you bet. Let me give you a fun one. I would think this would not be an intense political or intense ethical discussion, but you know, you're at the end of your shift, and you're on the way to the hospital with a patient, and the patient is not in crisis, in extremis. You're no life threat here, really. You've begun your care of the patient. The procedures are done. The shift is ending at 3 o'clock. It's 5 of 3. You're in radio touch with the base. It's on the way to the hospital. You can stop at that base and switch crews, let the other crew on, give them a report all in 30 seconds. You can have the written report done. They could take the patient on and drop the patient off at the hospital, and you get off on time. The real benefit is that they are the oncoming shift, so that when they restock the vehicle, get the stretcher changed, they're ready for the next call. If that call should come in while you still have a patient, they're sitting at the base collecting they're sitting at the base collecting their pay. You're getting overtime or being delayed for the rest of your life at that moment, that evening or whatever, while you're out on this unknown call you're going to be on. So to me, the switch seems simple, easy, obvious, and not an issue. I will tell you that it's a 50-50 split. I don't know what's going to happen on this phone call when you guys hear it in the room in Orlando. The general tone of the room was, that's not a problem, and because you're maintaining continuity of care, there's really not an issue. It's a good business practice. It's a good business practice. And by the way, you're handing off the patient to another practitioner anyway. Who cares at what stage you're doing it? At the same time I say that, my colleagues where I work, many classrooms where I am and present this, many settings where I present it, think it's abhorrent, and I deserve to be fired for suggesting it, and anybody else that would do that would be terminated, and the conversation will be lively with the room split as intensely as any – that's why I even call it political. It sounds like a political debate, because people will be right to switch and no right to switch down the line.
So, but on what basis do they object? Is it that they're
– continuity of care. Continuity of care.
So purely continuity of care, nothing to do with the potential risk to the patient in the transfer of care.
You can set the stage. I mean, we can write the stage that this patient has no risk at all. It's purely your patient, your continuity of care until you drop them off at the hospital. And if you've begun that call with that patient, you cannot hand it over to anybody else before they get to the hospital. To me, that's absurdist. But the fact that I suggest that is equally absurdist to them.
Interesting, because using their own argument, then they should check into the hospital, take off their uniforms, put on scrubs, and look after them in the ER and follow them into the into the hospital unit until they're discharged.
Until they drive them home.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's continuity of care.
Well, don't forget rehab. But
right.
Yeah, exactly.
And social work follow-up and all sorts of – but, you know, I think – one of these things that happens here is, like, you know, who do you want making that decision? Do you want the crew to be able to make that decision independently, or is that something that a shift supervisor says, hey, you know, we're going to have you switch as you go by the station? And, you know, there's also the, like, I think we can agree that the care that you provide at the end of a long shift may not be equal to the care that you provide at the beginning of the shift. So it could be the patient could potentially get better care by making the crew swap out. But I could also say that, you know, well, what if only one person wants to switch? Somebody else is trying to make a car payment, and they say, gosh, I need this hour of overtime. I'm not getting out, but you can. And so we only switch half the crew out.
Well, as I say, it's a fun case because it's one that when you're on one side or the other, it can seem so clear that you look at the other side of it and you think that other person is like a hydra, you know, like a head of nine snakes are so bizarre for the way they think the way they do, and you're so right. And yet the conversation can run where people can argue it both ways. I don't understand how the other people think. I don't know.
Well, and I think
No, please go ahead, Rob.
I think that's the fundamental tenet in teaching ethics, is to help students to be able to question their own assumptions and explore different sides of the issue and attempt to look at things from different perspectives, because oftentimes they come in with a single set of lenses with an ability only to look at things from one dimension. And that's one of the things I enjoy about teaching ethics, is putting them into groups and having them to, you know, forcing them to not just make one decision. I want you to give me at least two alternatives, maybe three, and argue the pros and cons of each of those, regardless of what your immediate reaction is to that case.
That is it. That's the gold standard. And even when I do the case, I demonstrated that, because I've got version A, B, and C. So while the first version might be simple and straightforward, you add a little edge of complexity. You can find that midpoint where you split the group and color it to where you set the stage. Now you're sitting on the fence. That, otherwise, it's not an ethical problem. It's just a simple, straightforward management solution or judgment.
Bill, I have a final question before we move on to recommendations, and that is, you know, you've been at this 40 years. Have you seen a change in paramedic students and how they puzzle through ethical dilemmas, either in the classroom or actually in the field?
You know, I'm going to have to go back to when I told you I was that young kid that was so, like, lack of an awareness of what the future was. I think that when you are the young person just coming out, that what is right and what is wrong is so clear and so easy. And after you've lived through enough ethical nightmares and seen enough of the variety of life and what it has to offer, now the ethical challenges become more real and more vivid to you, and how more difficult they are to answer and how much more you struggle with it. So I think it's more generational. I think it's more of the more experienced, the more professional people get, the further along they get in their career, the more reflective they become, and the more they examine that, and the more they have respect for the honor and the onus they have for taking care of people and making those judgments. So I don't know that there's a real trend in how people are doing things differently, except to go back to my first point here, the social media have changed things, because there are people doing things today with social media that are inexplicable. Let me just give you one case. It's not an EMS case particularly, but it was in Nebraska in our World Herald paper and on our news yesterday. I don't know how it wouldn't have gone viral yet. Maybe everybody knows about this by the time you hear this. But a young lady robbed a bank, stole a car in Nebraska, robbed a bank, and then put it on YouTube with flashing around the money and held a sign here, "I just robbed a bank and here's the gun I used." And of course, she got arrested. And this just happened. And I sit and go, what made somebody who robbed a bank think it was a good idea to put the confession on YouTube? Right. So how are people thinking? I think that's really the process is changing now in our electronic media. Time is moving much faster. Decisions are moving much faster. And I think the lessons for ethical lessons are going to be hard, too, when people find out, well, you know, just like that young lady isn't going to get a job 10 years from now. Isn't going to get, you know, that's going to affect her 20 years from now for the rest of her life by that slip of judgment. Now, bank robbery is a pretty extreme case, but there you have it.
Okay. I'll put a link to that video in the show notes. Bill, you also sent, maybe I'll include these other links that you sent, this Word document. Maybe you just want to say what the context is of these. And I'll post them in the show notes. You wrote some reading recommendations and then candidate clippings. Maybe just give us what the context of those is.
Were you asking me, Bill?
Yes, yes. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure. One of them is an article I actually wrote for Teaching Ethics in EMS for the Domain 3, the journal, the peer-reviewed journal for the National Association of EMS Educators. And it has these cases and a couple of others that I've talked about, so that anybody that wants to use the cases can use them as foundational cases for what they might present to the class, and a little bit of what was in there as to why it's difficult to teach ethics. So that's described in that article. And of course, the next one, which I thought was really excellent and was so honored by it, was the follow-up one that Greg Fries did, where it made recommendations, actual operational recommendations based on words I said. So I wish I had said them that well, but it was well stated.
I'm a good editor.
Yeah, there you go. And I don't know how many of these you're going to post, but there were any number of ones I provided to you. John Sinclair wrote about EMS being held to a higher standard and the kind of things that are done there. Washington, D.C., the worst in history from 2009. And just to talk about the damage that can be done to your service and your reputation, because these things will appear there years later. Any number of them are there. Things, one from 2000 saying it never goes away. Public information just never goes away. There was a case in New Jersey and an action taken, and just say, gosh, here we are, 12, it's going to be 13 years later. And when you just do a search on EMS ethics or whatever, and up it pops. And so these things linger around there once they're in the electronic milieu. That may be the most important lesson.
Okay, great. Great. Well, Rob and Bill Toon, typically we've been ending shows with the recommendation. Maybe it's a book, an article, an event, a software app, something that you want to share with other EMS educators. And Bill Ranovich, as we talk, if there's something that you want to add as a recommendation, we'd be happy to include that as well. Rob, you want to lead us off?
Sure. Let me see if I got my okay, good. I wasn't sure if I had my mic muted or not. Yeah, I wanted to tell our listeners about a social networking site. Speaking of social networks and getting yourself into trouble, this one is called Celly, and I've just signed up for it. It's CELLY, and the URL is simply CEL.LY, and it's a social network, and it's aimed it's free. It's aimed primarily at large groups, including educators and schools, and enables students to communicate with their teacher within what they call cells. And they can do that either through the web or they can do it through Twitter. And they can. It's also a website that enables instructors to do polling and multiple choice, and you can do it with unlimited numbers of people. So I just only recently learned about Celly and signed up, and it looks quite interesting. I'm anxious to try it out with my class. So that's my tech tip for the week.
Great. Thanks for sharing. Yeah, I'd seen that come through recently, and I was like, oh, I don't need another thing. But now, based on your recommendation, maybe I'll take a closer look at it. Mm-hmm. Bill Toon?
Well, I have to tell you, I've been delinquent, so I'll have to think of something for our next gathering. So everyone have a good holiday.
Okay. Well, I might be the sort of last to know, but all of a sudden recently I've been seeing all these mentions of something called, and I'm probably not even going to say it right, but tranexamic acid, TXA, which is a medication right. That inhibits the breakdown of clots. It's an anti-fibrinolytic. And there's been a bunch of research related to administration to trauma patients and severe hemorrhage and interest in it because it's really inexpensive. It's easy to administer, and it appears to work quite well. And so I've just been reading up on it. There's this study called the CRASH II study that enrolled 20,000 patients at sites around the world. So I think that's worth a look into. And what's also interesting to me is because this is a generic medication that's been available for a long, long time and used for a bunch of things, from what I gather, there's not a big incentive from the drug companies to market and publicize this medication for use by hospitals. So one of the researchers, principal researcher with this CRASH II study, has been doing things like making a comic strip and a YouTube video and really working to promote this medication to try to get it more widely used. So I think it's interesting in that regard too. And I think the thing for paramedic instructors to be looking at this is that some of what I've read just recently is suggesting that maybe the earlier that this is given, the better. And when they say earlier, does that mean early, like once the patient's at the hospital, or early once they're in the operating room, or does it mean early, like out in the field in an ambulance or on the incident scene? So I'll put a link to that Crash 2 website and a lot of great resources there.
I think they're talking early in the field. Our flight paramedics in Ontario are administering tranexamic acid. And there's a really good podcast by Dr. Scott Weingart on the EM Crit podcast.
Yeah, I listened to that right before we got on the air tonight, episode 67. And I'll put that in the show notes as well. That's great to hear. I kind of poked around and I couldn't find any Google search links that came up with U.S. paramedics, but it's based on just the odd sort of spellings. It looked like maybe in the U.K. or Canada or Australia, maybe paramedics were administering this. So international listeners, make sure you share your experiences.
Yeah. I had a multi-system trauma patient a couple of weeks ago. Could have used it for.
Yeah. Did you call for the helicopter?
No. We were about a 15-minute drive from the trauma center, so we went straight there. It was a pedestrian struck, so there was no access, egress, or extrication issues either. So
nice.
Yeah.
Bill Rainovich, anything you want to add, a recommendation, a book, an article, an app, an event?
No, I think I've made a lot of recommendations here, and just I'm not one to be recommending apps too much or any of that. I'm sort of the old dinosaur school, but thank you very much for having me here. It's been an honor.
Well, it's been terrific, and listeners, I've sort of by my tally sheet here, I think we mentioned at least six different ethical dilemmas that you could present in the classroom. So if you're thinking, now what do I do, go back and listen to this episode, and also just sort of keep an eye on the national or international EMS news websites, because I think quite frequently we end up in the news, and true events or events loosely based on the truth can often times lead to great classroom discussions. So
we should start up an ethics page on Facebook, so we can both generate ideas about ethical dilemmas and breach ethics simultaneously.
Probably not such a good idea, Rob. I'm just going to weigh in here on that ethically.
Come on, it's all part of the sport.
Well, Rob's going to slowly saw off the limb that he's sitting on by breaching those things on Facebook. But meanwhile, listeners and Bill and Rob and Bill, thanks so much for listening.